You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard Lopate on this overcast afternoon. For decades, millions of Americans heard the evening news every night from Peter Jennings, the longtime anchor of ABC's World News Tonight. A new book, Peter Jennings, A Reporter's Life, has just been published. It's an oral history of sorts, a collection of stories about Peter Jennings from his family, friends, colleagues, and competitors. The book was edited by Kate Darnton, Casey Freed Jones, and Lynn Scher, and was published by Public Affairs. I'm pleased that it brings Casey Freed Jennings, who was Peter's wife, and Lynn Scher, a longtime colleague, to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Welcome.
Thanks, Julie. So nice
to be here.
Thanks
for having us.
You know, this is an unusual book in that it really is a collection of remembrances woven together. It sounded, in fact, as I read it, it sounded like a radio show. It's the sort of thing we in radio or you in television do, where you talk to a lot of people about someone who was beloved and who had died. What led you to choose this form for a remembrance of him?
Well, I guess I'll start it off because...
It was your idea.
It was my idea.
That's a good way to start.
Peter died on a Sunday in August, and ABC News immediately started conducting a series of interviews to prepare for what would become a two-hour special that aired on the following Wednesday in remembrance of Peter. And during the course of those couple of days, 81 interviews were conducted. And I was one of the people that was interviewed. I was also trying to help out, although it was not my program. And the interviews were being emailed back and forth because it was such a huge project and because nobody knew where the producers were who were doing it. So they were being emailed on the mass email. So we all saw the
transcripts. So that it basically was reply everyone and you saw all the transcripts?
Well, they were just being send all, essentially. Mm-hmm, so... Mm-hmm. I was opening the little attachments and reading them all, and I sat there, like everybody else, I was deeply saddened by Peter's loss. He was not only a colleague, he was one of my very dear friends, but I was riveted by the depth, by the richness, by the detail of these interviews with some extraordinarily articulate people. And my instant reaction was this ought to be a book. Mm-hmm. And I called Casey immediately and I said, Casey, this is just great material. We've got to turn this into a book. And Casey said,
No.
At that moment, I can imagine, right? It was right after his death.
Well, it was right after his death. And I obviously wasn't thinking as clearly as Lynn was at the time. But I also feared a sort of tribute book.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't what Peter would have liked. He never wanted to be the center of the story. I could just feel him squirming. His children agreed with me. So we all said no.
Even at the beginning of the book, there's a question of whether he would even want something like this.
That's exactly right. But Lynn persisted, both as a friend, she persisted and put the interviews together, just compiled them, took out the ers and the es, and presented those of us in the family with this bound volume almost a year to the day after Peter died. And I stayed up all night that night reading it. But it didn't take long to realize what Lynn had seen and that she was absolutely exactly right. There was such immediacy and such passion and such understanding in these interviews. And they went far beyond merely Peter the man, but to his values and to his values of journalism. And I felt that therefore we could do something that was really more significant and use Peter as the vehicle to do this book.
And just to finish it off, the way that I put it together in this very private edition, which was for family and close friends, was essentially alphabetical by interviewee. Mm. So we just took the transcripts.
And
you know what a transcript looks like,
absolutely.
Right? And we just kind of cleaned them up very, very slightly and just presented them in a Q&A format. And what we've done, as you know, for this book is taken all those interviews, rearranged the little sound bites, if you will, chronologically according to Peter's life, and woven through as well is a narrative that connects it and, more importantly, quotes from Peter.
Some of his own words.
Interviews, letters, scripts, transcripts, so that what you get is a really complete picture of this extraordinary man as told by the people that knew him best in what I think turns out to be a conversation about Peter, which is, as you mentioned earlier, very much in the tradition of what radio and certainly public radio does.
Right. You know, in reading it myself, there were things that surprised me partly because he was a very public man, but there were things about him that those of us who watched him on television didn't know. And I was curious, as you read through these transcripts, were there things that surprised you as people who knew him very, very well?
Actually, there wasn't a lot that I didn't know. There were details of stories, because there's so many incredibly fun and wonderful and stories about Peter and about the sort of behind-the-scenes stuff in television news and in journalism and in his life. But nothing really surprised me except how clearly all these people, all these disparate people, because you're talking about family, you're talking about friends, you're talking about sources, how clearly they saw Peter. They got him.
Mm-hmm.
And that surprised me, because I knew him really well, and I knew what made him tick, and I knew what was really annoying about him, and I knew what was great about him. But I didn't realize how well other people got him. And I think that comes through very clearly. In fact, we left in some of the redundancy because it was so interesting. People use the same language to describe him.
Yeah, there's a section where it talks about him when he was on the road, about having a reporter's notebook stuck in the back of his pants, between his shirt and his pants. And it was such a vivid image. And it was an image that was repeated by a number of people.
Yeah, it's interesting, the things that everyone sort of noticed and were so memorable for them about it, and that notebook and the fact that no one could read anything that was in it.
his secret code.
That's right.
You know, you asked if we found out anything surprising about Peter, and certainly Casey knew him extremely well. I knew him quite well. I think the answer is that readers will find things that will surprise them enormously. This man who appeared so suave and debonair on the air, who hardly ever missed a beat, hardly ever stumbled, was in fact, in real life, a guy who was happiest running around in sweats. And Casey, what are his son Christopher's words about describing
Peter?
Yeah,
he describes Peter, he says, as a father, he could be fundamentally goofy. And, you know, I always say that only if you're suave and debonair can you get away with being fundamentally goofy. And he couldn't. That was part of his charm.
You know, one thing that I learned from this was that he was also a passionate jazz fan.
Yes.
And from a friend, I saw something where Wynton Marsalis said that he and Peter Jennings did the same thing. They improvised. Yeah. And I wondered whether Peter Jennings felt that way about the work that he did, whether it was improvisatory.
I think Peter's enormous talent as an anchor. And we can talk about this later, but it's a given that he was a great reporter. And when I say it's a given only because he worked really hard to get himself that way and he had good instincts. But it's one thing to be a great reporter. It's quite another to also be a great anchor. And Peter, as a great anchor, was a combination of having the experience, having the background, knowing what he was talking about, and, as you just said, being able to wing it, being able to improvise. There was very little that could throw him on the air. He could take the most horrible moment, the most glorious moment, and react exactly appropriately on the air. And I think those two examples that I would give are his 9/11 coverage, when he hit exactly the right tone and did the reporting and yet was a kind of unifier and a comforter for the nation. And then the millennium, where he was able to celebrate the glory of our world, turning a page on the calendar in a way that I don't think anybody else could have done.
Well, probably the best way to remember that, I'm sorry to interrupt, is let's listen to a little bit. We have a clip of Peter Jennings on 9/11. Just a warning to you as listeners, I know when I read this in the book, it brought up all of those moments for me. So this does bring you right back to that day.
ABC's Peter Jennings is at the anchor desk uptown here in New York and is now in position. Peter, I suspect you are looking at exactly the same pictures. Well, I know you're looking at the same pictures we are.
We are, Charlie. We've been watching it from the beginning. We'll be watching this for much of the day. There is chaos in New York at the moment. There have been not one but two incidents, as Charlie and Diane have so ably reported so far. The second one coming at 9:03, when television was on live and you could see what was clearly a jet aircraft flying into the second Trade Tower. Both Trade Towers now, these 110-story high towers, have now been hit. There is chaos here, there's chaos in the immediate area. There is confusion in Washington, because now everybody is engaged in this. The Pentagon is involved in this. All the intelligence services are engaged at this in the morning. And as we look at those towers, let's just simply keep looking at these towers this morning. And if you have the feed at home, I actually don't have it here, so somebody could please make sure that I have the photo picture of what's going on.
I think what you obviously heard there was Charlie Gibson, who had, was the anchor of Good Morning America, throwing it to Peter, who had just after 9 o'clock, I guess, just gotten in. Let me make an observation as a longtime colleague and someone who was greatly admiring of Peter's work. One of the things you might have noticed in that, besides the tone that he set, was when he said, let's keep looking at those pictures, what he was doing was literally directing the show. He was yes. telling the director, please keep the shots of the World Trade Center on the air. Do not come back to me. Do not, as the director's instinct would have been, don't come back to the studio and show the anchor. Let's watch that. That's what I, and that's the kind of thing that he used to do.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, certainly in that sort of live broadcast, there was a lot of improvisation. But I want to go back, if you don't mind, to your earlier point or your earlier question. He also, what made him a great reporter was he did improvise as a reporter. He knew that part of being a reporter, part of being a journalist, was to confront the unexpected and go with it and not be rigid in what you think a story is or should be. And there are several stories that are told in the book about Peter playing the map game, you know, yes. sitting around in Moscow
pointing,
in a lull
right.
and just closing his eyes and pointing at the map and saying, okay, let's go there and find a story.
And finding a bread line and finding people waiting for gas and finding a guy who is selling a chicken from right. his backyard, which is the sort of story that you would never...
And I'm absolutely convinced that you could have put Peter down anywhere in the world, in the middle of a desert or on any street corner, any town of this country, in this country or any other country, and he would have five stories in 15 minutes.
I'm speaking with Casey Freed Jennings and Lynn Scher about a new book called Peter Jennings, A Reporter's Life. And it's interesting that you chose A Reporter's Life as the name of this book, not An Anchor's Life. And as you, Casey, are just talking about, that his role, he had a dual role. He was a reporter and he also was an anchor. Was it tough for him to reconcile those two different persona, which in a sense, there's things that are similar about being a reporter and an anchor, and there are things, as we heard in that clip about 9/11, that an anchor needs to do that a reporter does not.
Mm-hmm. I think he actually loved both of them. If he had to give one up, it's easy. He'd give up the anchoring. Being a reporter is who he is and what he loved. He loved, though, that with doing the anchoring, it gave him a certain control, it gave him a certain bully pulpit, it gave him some power to get things on the air in a way, in the ways he thought was important, or to get things on the air that might not otherwise get there. So he certainly liked the power and control it gave him, both in the big picture and on a regular daily basis in fashioning his broadcast. But he was a reporter. And so the best thing was that he was able to do both. He could be an anchor, but because he was an anchor, he had the power to do documentaries, for example, which are reporting.
And so if someone had said to him, you have to sit in that chair in this studio, he probably would have said, okay, that's enough. Let's
yes.
try something else.
Yes.
And I think also you find in the book story after story of colleagues, of producers, of other correspondents saying that they were always dazzled by the reporting that he would do in the field. Peter was not one of these anchors who would get there and expect everything to be handed to him. He was out there with that little reporter's notebook, pulling it out from the back of his trousers and asking the questions. He never stopped asking questions, which was one of the things that I think made him such a great reporter. I think another was he definitely had something that I have taken to calling the wonder gene. My parents, thank goodness, gave it to me, and Peter certainly got it from his folks. He was curious about everything. He wanted to know. It wasn't something he superimposed on this job that he took up. This was part of his makeup, and I think it's extraordinary.
I'm speaking with Casey Freed Jennings and Lynn Scher about the life of news anchor and reporter Peter Jennings. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lope today, and I'm speaking with Casey Freed Jennings and Lynn Scher about Peter Jennings, A Reporter's Life. Just before we went to the break, Lynn and Casey, Lynn, you were talking about the wonder gene. And that was one of the things that struck me in reading this book. One of the things I didn't know was that Peter Jennings never had a real formal education. He didn't even finish high school. Was that wonder gene the thing that allowed him to to go beyond that and become the Peter Jennings that we all knew on television?
Well, I think part of it, yeah, for sure. I mean, I think Peter always loved to learn. I mean, I wasn't there with him when he was a kid, but he just couldn't learn in the classroom. The classroom was confining for him.
Which might be why he was such a great reporter, is there he was in the world rather than in a room.
I think that's right. And I think as soon as he was allowed out, which I don't think his parents were thrilled about, but as soon as he was allowed out of the classroom, he went on to learn more than one could imagine. He knew how to learn in a very profound way. He knew that everything was interesting, and he knew how to find what was most interesting in everything he encountered. He was never bored. He didn't understand people who were bored. He was disdainful of the idea of boredom. He was not cynical at all, which is where the Wonder Gene comes into it, I think. There was nothing cynical about him, and again, he couldn't understand people who were. There was this just interest in everything around him, everywhere.
And it wasn't just about the news. It was about life in general. Peter could make you crazy. You'd be sitting in the back seat of a taxi cab just wanting to get wherever you were going. Peter would look on the little ID card, call the taxi driver by name, and start having a conversation with him or her and ask all about them and where were they from and what were they up to. And he never stopped. He was genuinely interested in everyone and everything. After some event at the office, he gave me a ride home in his car, and we were driving by Midtown, and I said, you know, I haven't seen the Christmas tree yet. Could we just run over and take a quick look? The Rockefeller Center tree. And the car went over, and all I wanted was to look at it and go home. Peter stopped the car. Mm-hmm. Got out. Needless to say, people started swarming around him, tourists from all over the country. He chatted with everyone, and it wasn't about him. He asked them about them. This is what he liked to do.
You know, it's interesting you say that Peter could drive you crazy. The one challenge, I would imagine, one of the challenges in writing a book like this is that, especially right after someone dies, it's hard to remember, or you don't want to remember, the things that made you nuts about the person. And
but Peter's were so cute.
Well, and reading about him.
Oh, some of them, and not to all of us, Casey.
Well, it was interesting. I mean, one place where I could hear real honesty was when people talked about what he was like as an editor, about being called into his office to say, Peter wants to see you about your story, and the kind of tension that would happen in a newsroom when you would have to bring your story. Did that happen to you, Lynn, when you...
Well, not really.
Because she's so good.
Yeah, I'm so good he never would touch my scripts. But also, by the time Peter
He was scared of her.
I like to think he was a little afraid of me, but, you know. By the time Peter was the powerful soul anchor that he was, I was already a 2020, so I didn't deal with him that much in terms of scripts. I did deal with him on the air for live coverage of space shuttles, of political conventions, and various other special events. And I, like everybody else, fell victim to the classic Peter Live on the Air syndrome, which was just before you were about to go on, he would whisper in your ear, or in your earpiece, right? You'd be off in some remote location. Well, Lynn, what do you want to talk about when we go on the air? And I'd say, oh, I really want to talk about Senator so-and-so's this because it's really important. Peter would say, great. He would then come to you, and then he would ask a question that was approximately 180 degrees different from what you had already set up. And in his defense, he says he did it to keep us fresh, to keep probing, to keep going beyond what we had already prepared. Sometimes when you were on the air, you wanted to strangle him at that moment. But in the end, I think it was probably better for the audience.
Yeah, Cokie Roberts has a note in there about how he would ask you something right before you went on the air, her something right before she went on the air, and she'd give it to him, expecting that she would say it, but then he would say it, and then she would have to go beyond what
it
was.
Well, all anchors steal all correspondence lines. It is just goes with the territory. But Casey frequently makes the point, and I think she's quite right, that Peter was no less hard on himself than he was on everybody else, right?
It's true. I mean, you have to remember, even how many years into this job was he would call me at virtually every commercial to find out how I thought the show was going, how was he doing. Mostly he would call me about his own performance. And it would be really difficult because I wasn't always in front of a television, but he wanted someone who was going to be completely honest with him all the time, who was going to watch very closely and tell him when he should
do something different from what he was doing.
Exactly. Yeah. And be honest and say, no, you know, you can be better. You're low energy, you're high energy. That didn't make sense to me. I mean, he'd call when he was doing live stuff too on breaking news. And he just always wanted to be as good as he could possibly be.
Were you able to always be honest with him? I mean, that's a complicated situation. Somebody's on the air right at that moment.
Well, I learned. At first, he would call, and I would just be terrified because I would think somehow I was going to end up on the air or something. And I would freeze, or he wasn't going to get off fast enough. And so I would just stutter. Then I started telling him exactly what I thought, and that was not good. Because if he couldn't do anything about it, it wasn't useful.
Like, you can't say, God, that last shot was terrible.
Right.
They should have fixed it.
Or some piece that there's nothing.
Right.
But, so I learned at that moment to tell him what was useful and to be absolutely honest about it, but in a way that was constructive. So to say you're rushing it or you're not, or, you know, when you interviewed that guy who you're going to continue interviewing, you know, ask him this because I didn't understand that, or I want to know this. I would tell him if there was, as a viewer, there was information I wanted or needed or questions that I thought were interesting. But I stopped giving him sort of a blanket critique because it wasn't useful. And that's the kind of thing we talk about later. But he always wanted to know that.
It's so interesting because being a part of this business myself, that sort of response you don't usually get until much later. And so there is nothing you can really do about it until your next appearance. But that's fascinating that he was looking for minute-by-minute response.
And also, Peter was very responsive, sometimes frighteningly so, to his email while he was on the air. At commercial breaks, he would read his email. And you could, on one or two occasions, I would email him about something. I remember during, I think it was in the beginning of the invasion in Iraq, and there were, remember the scene, obviously, you certainly remember the toppling of the Saddam statue.
Yes.
And I emailed, where are the women? There was this sea of male Iraqis all over the place. And I was sitting at home, struck by the fact there were no women. And sure enough, a couple minutes later on the air, Peter was talking to somebody, and they got into the issue of why the streets were full of men and there are no women walking around, that kind of thing. He would not do it gratuitously. He would not do it if he didn't think it was a good idea. But he was open to what was going on around him and what his colleagues were thinking.
And he wanted that. He wanted people to be watching it closely. He wanted that input from wherever it could come.
What prepared him for that kind of a role? Because that's a complicated thing to learn how to do, to be able to perform. And as we heard in that clip on 9/11, as you said, Lynn, to set a tone that would then allow other people to take in information that was really difficult to take in.
And to synthesize.
And to synthesize
90
it.
Million things that were coming in at once.
How do you learn, how did he learn how to do that?
I think that those are almost two questions. I think one, the performer, the person able to take in all that information and deliver it in a very measured way, I think that came from his tradition, his upbringing. His father was a broadcaster. He
radio
grew up,
broadcaster,
right.
I was happy to see. Yes.
That's right. And Peter grew up in the broadcast world. He had his first radio show at age 9. He started doing it then. He then went on at a very young age to be a broadcaster himself. And so in a sense, that was maybe in his blood a little bit. And there's a very interesting story where his father, when he was a young man, young broadcaster, took him outside and said, look at the sky. And then he said, now look at me and describe it. And then he said, now look at the sky and divide it up into 8 separate pieces and describe them each separately. So he was trained in that sense, in terms of how he could take all these different things in. I think part of that's probably ADD.
Which might have been part of the challenge of school, too.
I mean, I'm sort of joking because I don't know. But
right, but ability to work on many planes at the same time.
And focus very intently for a short period of time on all of that. So he could take all the stuff in his ear, answer email, cut 3.5 seconds out of his script.
And call you on the phone and say, so how am I doing?
Or ask about dinner. Yes.
And there's a wonderful story in the book from Linda Franke, a close friend of Peter and Casey's. And she talks about the fact that she would occasionally get those phone calls during the commercial break. And it would be Peter calling up to say, are we going to serve hot dogs or hamburgers for the barbecue on Saturday? And Linda would be saying, and this is all in the book, "What, Peter, hang up. You're on the air. You can't talk to me now." But he could pull it off. He could do it all.
Did he like in his private life, too? Because it sounds like in the public sphere and as part of his work, keeping people a little bit off balance was something really important to him.
I let me answer that from my perspective first, which is the dead yes. It's a great question. I think socially as well as professionally, Peter very much wanted not to be taken for granted and wanted not to see things in the standard way. He was always going in the other direction and didn't want to be put into a box so that you wouldn't think just because he looks a certain way or acts a certain way that he is a certain person. He wanted the advantage of every single of the ability to look at things from all sides and to take all different positions. You couldn't really not pin him down politically, socially, in terms of what he cared about, in terms of which side he would be on. And I think that was very much part of his personality.
And personally, too, I mean, was living with Peter Jennings, you weren't sure exactly what was going to happen next?
Well, in the best sense, in the sense of adventure and living life to its fullest and never knowing what was around the next corner, that kind of thing. But you didn't live on edge. It wasn't that sense. I mean, he wasn't testing us all the time. He wasn't challenging us in that way, in any way. I mean, life with him was a great, wonderful adventure.
I'm speaking with Casey Freed Jennings and Lynn Scher about a book, Peter Jennings, A Reporter's Life. It's from Public Affairs Books. You know, the last chapter of Peter Jennings' life was a private and public chapter in that he went through something in public that most of us do in private. He was diagnosed with lung cancer. And I wondered how, for him, he reconciled that public and private, that this is something that's happening to him as a man, but he needs to share it with colleagues and also with the world because he's a public figure.
I don't think he hesitated. He made the announcement virtually immediately after the diagnosis was confirmed. He's a reporter. It was a story. He wasn't going to give someone else a story. He also thought he owed it to the viewers, and he owed it to people to tell the truth. We were both actually caught by surprise that people seemed to feel it was something brave. He certainly didn't feel it was brave. He thought it was just who he was and what he did. Apparently, there's a stigma attached to lung cancer. Neither he nor I realized that. And people seem very thankful that he was willing to come forth and be honest about what his cancer was and that he smoked. But that didn't occur to him at all at the time. And he was very comfortable doing what he did and wouldn't have done it any other way.
What was it like, Lynn, for you and your colleagues when you heard about this? I would assume he'd let you know first, or?
Well, I actually knew a little before the rest of the world because Peter had a speaking engagement lined up, and which was the very day that he made the announcement. So a few days before that, Casey called me up to say what she had a favor to ask, would I fill in for Peter at a speech, and understand this is the kind of thing we would all do all the time. You fill in for somebody if you can't show up somewhere. But this one was pretty special. And she said, would I fill in? And then she paused and she told me. And I took a long walk, not around the block, probably around halfway around the city, and cried a lot and came back and, got the speech ready so that I could deliver it a few days later. But there was a great sense of shock. In part, because you always feel that way about somebody that you care about, but also because Peter was our anchor in the very best sense of the word. He was not only a good friend, but our anchor professionally. He is the guy that in a way that anchors didn't used to, in fact, led the network. And the image of Peter was always this big, tall, gorgeous hunk who was rock solid. And the idea that he was vulnerable affected us all very, very deeply. I think the collective gasp from his colleagues at ABC News and certainly around the world was something that could be heard throughout the solar system. It was that shocking.
We have time for a very short question and answer. And I wondered what you hope this book will show in terms of Peter's legacy. What do you hope people will see in this?
Peter, I mean, aside from his values as a human being, Peter believed it was a great privilege to be a journalist, and he believed that it was a privilege to be asked to go search for the truth on behalf of all of us. And so I think his legacy is, you know, that the truth is really important. It's really hard to find, and you have to work very hard to find it, and you should never, ever stop looking or think that there's only one truth.
Casey Freed Jennings, Lynn Scher, thank you so much for joining me today. We've been talking about the life of news anchor and reporter Peter Jennings, a new book, Peter Jennings, A Reporter's Life, is out from Public Affairs.